fires, antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium...
Tom Lehrer embarking on his musical rendition of The Chemical Elements. The list of the 94 different types of atom which make up the rock, the seas, the atmosphere, and all living things on the planet. But 98% of the mass of the planet is made up of just 8 of those elements. The rest, such as helium, platinum, phosphorus, various rare earth and precious metals, are scarce. And therein lies the problem. Scientists are warning that we are squandering reserves of many of those essential materials, much as we have done with oil. I'm sitting in my kitchen, scraping off one of those 94 elements from my burnt toast, carbon. I'm using a very fine silver-plated knife to do the scraping, and once I've finished, I'll pour my coffee from my aluminium coffee pot into my porcelain coffee cup to enjoy as I read the news from the liquid crystal display of my laptop. I could say that I continually reflect on how lucky I am to benefit from such a rich variety of elements. But that would be a lie. Like most people, I tend to take them for granted. But we may not be able to for much longer, according to former government chief scientific officer, Professor Sir David King.
Many of these metals, whether they're rare earth metals, whether they're the precious metals such as platinum, rhodium, gold, or whether they are much cheaper metals such as copper, each one of them is a dwindling resource. So as we move forward this century, we are going to be, there's no two ways about it, about 9 billion people on the planet by mid-century, and we'll plateau out at about that number. Population growth is being brought under control. What isn't coming under control is consumption.
Phosphorus is the 15th chemical element. It has two solid forms, red and white, and makes up 0.12% of the Earth's mass. It is mined in the USA, Morocco, and the Middle East. It is highly reactive and used in the manufacture of matches, explosives, and most importantly, fertilizer.
It's the use of phosphorus in fertilizer that most worries industrial ecologist Roland Clift at the University of Surrey.
Phosphorus is essential for all life forms and can't be substituted by anything else. What we do at the moment is dig up phosphate rock, convert it into a form which is available to the plants, put it on the land, use it once. We eat it and quite literally piss it away, dispersing it into the oceans, where of course it goes at something like infinite dilution.
So how scarce has it become?
The estimates for known availability of phosphorus say that it would last a few decades. So within the lifetime of our children, certainly our grandchildren, phosphorus is going to become a scarce resource.
Phosphorus depletion plus population increase equals literally millions of starving
people. It's disaster, yes.
Geoscientists Harald Sverdrup and colleagues at the University of Lund in Sweden have calculated that silver, gold, zinc, tin and indium will become scarce within 30 years. But Professor Tom Gradle from Yale is more worried about copper, predicting that even with recycling, there will soon not be enough to meet global demand. Modern technology, including essential medical equipment, increasingly relies on a range of precious metals and other rare materials. Professor Sir David King sees trouble brewing as nations compete for dwindling supplies of resources in Africa and elsewhere.
What we're seeing is China, India joining the British, the European states and the United States in seeking out where they can get these scarce resources from, because in their own countries they've got very limited supplies. What about extrapolating forward to mid-century, with demand continuing to increase? I think we can look at scenarios, I'm now talking about global political scenarios, in which the issue of dwindling resources compared with demand may become the biggest new driver of conflict between nations.
Helium is the second most abundant chemical element of the universe, but is rapidly disappearing from the Earth. It is a colourless, odourless, tasteless, inert gas used in welding, fibre optics and microchip production. It is essential for cooling medical diagnostic equipment such as MRI scanners. Most of the world's helium lies under Texas.
There is a unique problem with helium. Because of its low density, helium that leaks from machines and party balloons escapes into outer space. It has been estimated that Texas will have run out of helium in 10 to 20 years, and that all the Earth's supply will have leaked away by the end of the century. Unlike other scarce materials which have simply become dispersed and inaccessible, helium will literally have disappeared out of this world.
Platinum is the 78th chemical element. It is a very dense, malleable, grey-white metal with unique characteristics which make it supreme as a catalyst in chemical reactions. It is extremely rare. Most of the world's supply comes from South Africa.
In platinum, we have an interesting example, both of the problem of material depletion and a possible solution, as I discovered on a trip to Birmingham. I'm walking down the road with Angela Murray, a researcher from Birmingham University, and she says she's going to take me to an urban mine of platinum. Angela, where is this mine and why is platinum so important?
Well, you'll see the mine in just a moment, but if we start with platinum, platinum's important because it's a metal that has a low abundance and a high technological importance, and that makes it expensive.
So, I mean, everyone knows that platinum jewellery is the way to go, isn't it? I mean, if you really want to impress your beloved one, you should give them a platinum ring. But, I mean, is it useful for anything else apart from it impressing people?
Of course it is. It has a huge number of uses. It's actually used extensively for making catalysts for industry in the production of electronic components like computer hard drives and LCD screens for televisions. It's also used in the medical industry for anti-cancer drugs and treatments. And actually over half of the platinum produced last year was used in autocatalysts. So the catalytic converters in your cars. And that relates to where I'm taking you now. Here we are then, Mark.
We seem to be at the junction of a busy road, and I can't see anything that looks like a mine here, Angela, and I certainly can't see anything that looks like platinum.
Well, you're standing on it, or certainly standing next to it, because the urban mine that we're talking about is actually all this road dust that's collecting here at the side of the busy junction. And the reason that it has platinum in it is because of the catalytic converters in people's cars. These catalysts are used to convert your exhaust emissions into less harmful ones. But because your exhaust is hot and the conditions are quite stressful in it, over time, tiny little pieces of metal break off the surface of your catalyst and are dispersed all over the road. So people are driving about every day, putting platinum into an environment, and they don't even realise it.
I mean, just so I can get a feel for this, how much of this dust would I need to have in my hand to make a ring?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it depends on the amount of platinum in the road dust, which, you know, depends on traffic flow and lots of other factors. But if you were to sweep a sort of typical city environment, then you would need to sweep 3 kilometres of road for a year in order to get about 30 grams, and that would make you a really nice ring, pair of earrings, necklace, whatever you wanted.
But all the platinum in all the road dust in all the world is unlikely to satisfy the growing demand for the material. Nick Morley, an environmental consultant with Oakdean Hollands, is co-author of a major government report on material depletion. We met at a pub near his office in Aylesbury. Nick, we're just getting our food, and a lot of people are worried about food security, whether there's going to be enough land in the world to create enough food for everybody. But if you look at the dishes in front of us, we've also got, you know, plates, ceramic plates and knives and forks, and all around us there's all these different materials. I mean, should we be worried about those disappearing too?
From a supply of materials point of view, we are not so concerned. But I think what we are concerned is about the environmental impact caused by the extraction of these materials and their purification and their incorporation into products. Metals in particular create something like 5 to 10% of the total CO2 emissions in the world through their extraction and purification. And for example, if we look at platinum, it takes about 600,000 tonnes of rock to be mined in South Africa to make a single tonne of platinum. There may be a time when society will have to choose not to mine particular metals.
Copper is the 29th chemical element, historically one of the first metals used by humans. It exists in large quantities in the Earth's crust, though only a small amount is economically retrievable. Soft and malleable, it has the lowest electrical resistance of any metal. It is the major constituent of nearly all electrical cables on the planet.
Copper's a really interesting case. It's one of the metals where people have identified that when the world gets to about 9 billion population, if everyone used the same amount of copper as we do in the US or in the UK, that we would physically start to run out of the thing.
Tin is the 50th chemical element and makes up less than 0.0001% of the mass of the Earth. Its resistance to corrosion makes it useful as a coating for other metals, as in the tin can. More than half of the world's tin ore is mined in the Great Far Eastern Tin Field.
In theory, the economics of supply and demand should prevent material shortages. As supplies diminish, prices rise, and the mining of certain metals, once thought uneconomical, gain a new lease of life. This certainly appears to be true in relation to tin mining in Cornwall, where a 4,000-year-old tradition of mining, which had ground to a halt just over a decade ago, is starting up again. At the South Crofty mine near Redruth, exploratory drilling for ore is well underway. I was taken underground by Western United Mines Chief Operating Officer, John Webster.
We are about 25 metres from surface, at about probably the start of our main decline, our main exploration decline. We are concentrating on one particular zone, which is at the high-grade end of the historic Dogcote mine.
So we're standing next to a machine that looks like a crashed JCB.
It's an Atlas Copco U6 diamond coring rig. We use this to basically drill holes in the rock through this ore body in various directions and depths to determine what's in the rock.
Obviously, this is the kind of the start of a new life of this mine. How is this possible? Is this new technology?
The company identified an opportunity to reevaluate the historic sections of the particularly the Dolcote deposit, which was a massive producer of both copper and tin. And we believe there's quite a lot of material left, which is now economic due to the increase in price. The old guys, if you like, were mining at a 2% tin cutoff, and we'll be looking at a 0.2% tin cutoff, which is a significant difference.
That is a huge difference.
That is also when it's combined with other metals, which are basically along for the ride, such as zinc and copper, and that would, in some cases, make tin a byproduct.
So what are your thoughts about those who say that we're going to run out of metals very soon and that we should all be very worried?
In a nutshell, it's rubbish. There are huge amounts of metal contained within large amounts of rock all around the world, some of them not explored yet. So there's no shortage of minerals.
So can we rely on simple economics to control the situation for all materials? David Hardgreaves has been a coal miner, an economist, and is now a chartered mining engineer. Like John Webster, he gives short shrift to those who warn that we are running out of materials like platinum or copper.
It's a doomwatch scenario, and it's really put about by people who don't have a basic grasp of economics. If you took, say, the year 1900, and you went looking for copper, you would have to find yourself a deposit in which the rock in the ground had to have 3, 4 or even 5% of copper to make it payable. Because that was the price of copper versus the cost of recovering it. Today, under certain circumstances, 0.5% of copper is payable. There is no shortage whatever of very, very low-grade materials for the foreseeable future, but they will come at a price.
Is there a crisis about materials?
No, again, there's no real crisis. If we take the fact that the world is 25,000 miles round, which means, if you divide by pi, that it's about 7,000 miles deep. The deepest we've been into the crust is 3 miles, and that's exceptional. That's in South Africa, in the gold mines. 2/3 of the world is covered by water, so we've only explored a tiny amount of the crust to a very shallow depth. What on earth can there be in between, down at depth, on the seabed and below it? Vast amounts of it, but I must stress, it's the price at which you get it.
Back at the University of Surrey, I asked industrial ecologist Professor Roland Clift if he accepted the economist's argument that the free market will drive technologists to find viable ways of extracting materials.
Yeah, I love economists. They don't understand technology. The simple economic elasticity kind of model does not apply to scarce materials which are not mined in their own right. If the demand for something like a scarce metal goes up enough that the existing sources of that material are not sufficient to satisfy the demand, then you're into a completely different production regime and the costs go up to something totally orders of magnitude different.
But if you look at, let's say, the case of oil, which is a recent history, you know, in the 1970s, the price went through the roof. You know, it didn't start wars. What happened was technologists and scientists started getting on the case, and in the end, people got more efficient cars and the price of oil came down.
Yeah, there are various things in that. Oil is something which is produced in its own right, so the normal economic models are applicable. When looking at scarce materials like indium, tellurium, tantalum, normal economics don't actually apply because these are not produced as single products from a mining operation. Economics is basically a very short-sighted science.
So we've had the credit crisis and you think there's going to be a materials crisis?
Yes, yes, I do.
Neodymium, element number 60, is one of the so-called rare earth metals. Its extraordinary magnetic properties make it ideal for high-power, lightweight magnets for the electrical motors of hybrid cars and wind turbine generators. Most of the world's neodymium is in China.
Neodymium and other rare earth metals are essential to technologies being developed to combat climate change. The problem, as with other scarce materials, is that supplies are not uniformly distributed around the globe. Nick Morley again.
What is happening in the case of neodymium and some other metals, which are mined maybe exclusively at the moment in one place, is that those countries are introducing controls on how much can be exported outside of the country. They want to hold on to those materials for their own uses and perhaps to make the components in their own country rather than just export the metal or the ore outside. And so that's getting other countries like our own concerned about that, whether they can get access to those materials. So it's not really a scarcity issue, but it is a geopolitical issue.
That countries might stockpile materials to protect their monopolies also worries Professor Sir David King, rare earth metals in particular.
The rare earths are absolutely critical to your plasma television screen. They're critical to every mobile phone. Things that we're now getting used to as part of the modern way of life absolutely critically depend on rare earths. At the moment, 95% of the world's rare earths come from one part of the world, that's China. So as we move forward in time, there's a big attempt now to find rare earths elsewhere, and some sources have been found. But whether we will find additional resources that are easily available as they are in China is a very big question.
But David Hargreaves remains confident that the economics of the free market will deal with any material scarcity.
South Africa is in an unusual, if not unique, position in that of the 20 major mineral commodities in the world by value, it has a good handle, not so much a monopoly, but a good handle on about six of them. If the South African economy could afford it, they could dictate the price, for example, of chrome, manganese and platinum in particular. They have massive reserves of them and they could control that price, but their economy is sufficiently fragile for them to have to continue to sell as they produce.
So you're saying that actually people worrying about China stockpiling are completely unwarranted, because actually China would be roughly in the same position, right? It has an economy that it wants to grow, so why would it hang on to stuff?
Yes, it can't afford to. The rate at which the Chinese economy is growing is such that it has to keep it on the boil. And it couldn't keep it on the boil, for instance, by stockpiling a year's supply of iron ore. It simply could not afford to do it, or copper, or anything else which is necessary for its economy. It has to keep it boiling. Yeah.
The rising prices of scarce resources is providing the incentive and even inspiration for scientists and mining engineers to solve the problems. At Birmingham University, Professor Lynn McCaskey has developed an intriguing low-energy way of extracting usable platinum from road dust. She takes over after her colleague Angela Murray has processed it into a rather murky soup and introduces some fairly common garden bacteria.
The secret is that bacteria, which are very similar to the ones that you get in your biological drinks, can do fantastic things with the platinum. And these are very friendly bacteria in a different way, because they can actually recover the platinum out of the soup, which means we don't have to send it off for refining. Because we have it recovered, we can then use it for different things.
Professor McCaskey demonstrated how this recovered platinum could be used to help power the eco-friendly cars of the future.
We have this square of black material, which is actually carbon, and we put onto that dried bacteria with their platinum, and in this form, the carbon and the bacteria make an electrode for a fuel cell.
Fuel cells are not the only applications for Professor McCaskey's friendly bacteria.
We've got fuel cells here, we've got green chemistry over there, we've got hydrogen there, we've got nuclear waste here.
Nuclear waste, really?
Yes, we've got a nuclear waste project as well. It's possible to use friendly bacteria to hoover uranium out of mining wastes.
So is this the answer for all recycling? I mean, in a sense, I can imagine you designing a bacteria that we can just put into a waste dump and it essentially will take out any metal we want or any materials. Is that possible?
Well, that is possible, but nature isn't quite that clever, so we would then have to think about genetic engineering. And it's probably better to have a shelf full of bacteria like products, and so for a particular waste you have a particular bottle, and you can mix and match the contents of your bottles, obviously. So if you had a complicated waste, you'd select maybe 3 or 4 bottles off the shelf.
This technology is still in its infancy. It's impossible to say what impact it may have in the long term. Meanwhile, what about solutions to Professor Roland Cliff's concerns about phosphorus?
If I am right, and that we end up in a position where we have to find phosphorus from sources other than the phosphate rocks which are mined at the moment, then one of the options is to recover it from very low concentration in the oceans, which will take a lot of energy. Another alternative which some people talk about is, suppose we go to another planet and mine things like scarce metals or phosphorus and bring them back to Earth. Now, if the sums have been done, I have yet to see them. They need to be done. This is something I intend to work on over the next year or so. But my strong suspicion is that the amount of energy you would have to expend to go to, say, Mars and dig up something and then transport it back to the Earth would be even bigger than the amount you need to put in to recover it from very low concentration in the oceans. For a bulk commodity like phosphorus, I can't see that extraterrestrial mining is ever going to be viable. It might be for some critical metals where the actual quantities that we need are much smaller.
Environmental consultant Nick Morley pins his hope on scientists finding substitutes for depleted materials, such as plentiful aluminium replacing scarce copper in electrical wiring.
I think there are some cases where substitutability is going to be very difficult. And I think we see that in some of the very rare metals, things like platinum and palladium and the rare earth metals. But there are others where, yes, we can envisage through the use of things like nanotechnology, we might be able to use small quantities of perhaps more common metals and get special effects, get special properties that will enable us to substitute them. So I'm reasonably optimistic in that regard.
Where does that optimism come from? I mean, is it a faith in science to sort out a potential problem?
I think we can see there are some historical examples of substitutes. And I think we mustn't also forget the effect of economics, that what's going to happen as these materials become more difficult to extract, as they become more expensive, that will also drive the science and drive the substitutability of them.
Can science, driven by economics, really be relied on to save the day? The Earth's ecosystem perhaps gives us a clue. It employs an amazingly frugal use of materials, all of which are completely recyclable. Can it be beyond the wit of science and engineering to take a leaf out of nature's book and move us towards a less wasteful system of manufacturing? Professor Sir David King, after 45 years at the forefront of scientific research, is not optimistic.
It's very touching to hear other people putting such faith in the scientific community. But just recall, the prices of these metals now are driving research laboratories around the world to find alternatives. We're not there yet. This isn't to say we're not going to get a major breakthrough, but I don't think we can rely on the type of breakthrough we're talking about. We will have to look at alternatives, but we're going to, I think, have to readjust our whole approach to consumption. Consumption has got two sides to it. It drove our economies wonderfully in the 20th century. It's not relevant now. It's not fit for purpose in the 21st century. We're going to have to manage the process of consumption and try to put the notion of human well-being ahead of the notion of rampant consumption.
Professor Roland Clift also doubts that science can solve our resources problems on its own. He is particularly concerned about what he calls the environmental paradox, that the very technologies designed to address the energy crisis and reduce our carbon footprint rely on materials in scarce supply or need huge amounts of energy to extract.
The arch example of that is things like fuel cells. You know, some of the more ambitious estimates you'll see for cars running on hydrogen and fuel cells have not woken up to the fact that there is not enough platinum on the planet for those ambitious plans.
In contrast, the economist and mining engineer David Hargreaves remains optimistic about the future supplies of materials.
We needn't worry ourselves into an early grave. I think we have to be very concerned, and we are being very concerned, but that concern is in a way driven by economics. God bless the ecologists, yes, we need them, but economics is going to drive this. If something becomes too expensive, we'll find a cheaper way to do it. And so I think the equation will balance.
Despite reassurances about the force of economics and the resourcefulness of scientists and mining engineers, it's hard not to conclude that we are, at least to some extent, squandering our inheritance of materials, condemning future generations to a more depleted earth. The free market doesn't seem to prevent us guzzling crude oil, so perhaps it won't prevent us exhausting supplies of helium and phosphorus along with rare and precious metals. We've created a richly textured world from the 94 elements we inherited on the Earth. The cobalt blue of impressionist paintings, the cheery flash of a chrome-plated bicycle, the touchscreens on our phones have more than just an economic importance. The elements are part of our culture. They are all we have, and they are all we are, literally. We should look after them. It would be a shame to have to shorten Tom Lehrer's list.
There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, krypton, neon, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.